Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, September 14, 2018. A top U.S. diplomat says his government will not continue assisting South Sudan if the warring parties fail to honor their commitments.
Those mechanisms didn't work so well. So it wasn't a great investment by our taxpayers. And the reason they didn't work well is because the parties to the agreement broke the agreement almost at the beginning. You know, we can't just keep investing in a broken agreement.
And there are unconfirmed reports of fighting in Yei River State.
Their aim is to capture Mangala Torre and proceed up to Liwolo. So it continued yesterday when people were signing peace, were just clashing down in Kenji. Even this morning, today was the heaviest. They came at around 7 and immediately launched very heavy offense against opposition.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The U.S. ambassador to South Sudan says his country will not continue to fund peace agreements that are violated time and again by warring parties. Thomas Hashek says the parties that signed the revitalized peace deal must show a real commitment to ending violence, allowing free humanitarian passage, and releasing all political prisoners. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar has this report from Juba.
The United States, United Kingdom, and Norway, known as the Troika, released a joint statement this week expressing concerns over the signed revitalized peace agreement for the resolution of conflict in South Sudan. In an exclusive interview with VOA, U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan, Thomas Hosek, says the Troika wants to see a change from the past when peace deals were signed and violated within hours.
It's time to actually start the work of building peace. So our concerns are, you know, we need to see that going forward. And when we see a few things, like when there's still a little bit of fighting going on, and while there were some hostilities after the signing of the recommitment to the ceasefire, there are still places where humanitarian access gets blocked, by both parties, by the way. And so those are the kinds of things that concern us.
The top U.S. diplomat in South Sudan says the Kiir administration should immediately release all political prisoners and allow freedom of speech. As it is now, he says, civil society leaders in South Sudan operate in a repressive environment.
We're concerned that when there are arrests of civil society activists because of their political opinions or pressure put on them or other repressive means used against them, that this actually leads to an unhealthy civil society, a civil society that's too afraid to speak their minds and to participate in the process. And in that, if that happens, then people will not have confidence in their government's commitment to the peace process. Refugees will not have the confidence that security is going to improve and come home.
South Sudan Minister of Information Michael Makuei says the government is committed to implementing the revitalized peace agreement, but is skeptical that Troika will monitor the actions of all the parties who signed the deal.
There is no mechanism whereby you can measure the commitment of any person, but you only see it through deeds and through actions. So for the Troika to say, we will not believe it until we see it, let them wait and they will see. Whatever we say for them, they will not believe us.
Makuei also argued that the international community should provide financial support to implement the peace agreement.
If they want the agreement implemented, they are supposed to join us in the implementation so that we all work together. They back us, they back up the agreement so that it is implemented. Because implementation means money. It means funding.
The U.S. government provided funds to support the work of the Ceasefire Transitional Security Arrangement and Monitoring Mechanism, or CITISM, and the work of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or JMEC. But Hosek says this time around, his country is going to be more careful about doling out financial assistance.
Those mechanisms didn't work so well. So it wasn't a great investment by our taxpayers. And the reason they didn't work well is because the parties to the agreement broke the agreement almost at the beginning. So we can't just keep investing in a broken agreement. If this agreement proves to be workable and everything, I think you will see the world stepping up. Again, first and foremost, the parties to the conflict themselves have to make the commitment and the investment.
The parties to the conflict in South Sudan signed the final peace deal in Addis Ababa this week after lengthy negotiations in Addis Ababa and Khartoum. Under the deal, the pre-transitional period of 8 months is start immediately after the signing on Wednesday. The parties are supposed to form a revitalized transitional government of national unity that includes opposition groups which signed the deal. Riek Machar, chairman of the SPLM-AIO, is reinstated as first vice president of South Sudan for the duration of the transitional period. For VOA News, Amanyang David Mayar in Juba.
Just 2 days after signing the revitalized deal, rebels of the SPLAIO claim government forces have attacked their positions in Yei River State. SPLM-IO Deputy Military Spokesman Colonel Lam Gabriel claims government forces attacked Kinderi and Mangalatore in Kajokeji County. Paul tells VOA's James Batty the aim of government's reported attacks is to deprive the SPLAIO of any military bases in Kajokeji, a claim South Sudan in Focus could not independently verify.
This attack started on the 11th in Mangalatore, that's in Kajokeji. Their base is in Agana. They always leave the base and come to attack our position. Their aim is to capture Mangalatore and proceed up to Liwolo. So it continued yesterday when people were signing peace, we were just clashing down in Kajokeji. Even this morning, today was the heaviest. They came at around 7 and immediately launched very heavy offense against our position. Their major aim is to overrun us so that we don't have any base closer in Kajokeji.
It doesn't seem to make sense that just barely 24 hours or so after a peace agreement has been signed for the government of South Sudan or their forces to, as you put it, attack your position. Does that make sense?
It doesn't make sense, James Batty. It is not the beginning. It has always been the case. Even in 2015 when we signed the peace agreement, when Juba Batty people have been fighting us, they fought us in Eastern Equatoria, they even fought us in Yei River when Riek Machar was already in Juba in 2006. So we really know that this is going to continue. We are here negotiating peace. We even signed peace in good faith. But the regime, we don't know what kind of peace really they want. Because when we talk about peace, we say this is genuine peace, where there is not going to be shooting of guns anymore, where there is not going to be killing of people. But at the end, it's just a business as usual for them.
Many South Sudanese, they were very happy, or they are still happy, following the signing of the agreement. Even the IGA countries and the Troika, United Kingdom, United States, and Norway, also praised the signing of the agreement. But the Troika, they expressed reservation. They kind of cast doubt on whether this revitalization agreement will be fully implemented. They cited specifically these repeated ceasefire violations.
In fact, South Sudanese, if you have seen critical law, if you have followed, since the peace was signed, there has been no celebration at all. Whether in Juba or in the refugee camps or in the IDP camps, almost everywhere there has not been any celebration. The reason being, we are here talking about peace. We are trying to sign peace. Juba is preparing for war. And our civilians in Juba, they are seeing the preparation of the regime. So they know that this is not going to be the peace that they really want. And that's why if Troika have the reservation, they have their eyes on the ground. They have been receiving reports from CITESAM. They have been receiving reports from UNMISS. UNMISS have been giving them all these reports. So they know that Juba will never really implement this peace the way it's supposed to be implemented.
Colonel Lampaul Gabriel, thank you very much for speaking with us on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you.
That's SPLM-IO Deputy Military Spokesman Colonel Lampaul Gabriel speaking with VOA's James Batty earlier today. Jonglei State has been in the news throughout last year and for the better part of 2018. South Sudan in Focus reporters in Bor have filed stories on cattle raids, communal violence, child abductions, and night robberies. Colonel Philip Aguirre is the governor of Jonglei State. He is with me in the studio here in Washington to explain to our listeners why Jonglei State is making headlines. Governor Aguirre, thank you very much for coming to VOA at a very short notice. It means a lot to us.
Thank you very much. I value the work of the media. And I'm sure Jonglei State and Greater Jonglei have a lot of positive news. But I think the media is comfortable with the conflict issues rather than peace issues. We have been doing a lot on the side of peace and peace building between us and Buma,
yes,
between us and Bia, between us and Van Gogh. And this year we are more calm than any year in our history, in the modern history of Jonglei State. We have established a good relation with the administration in Pibor,
mm-hmm.
and Governor Yao Yao have made a record in the history to acknowledge that child abduction is a bad habit, cattle-raiding is a bad habit, and five of us, the governors of the five states of Jonglei, have agreed that we have to combat criminality. We are waging a war against criminality so that our people live in lasting peace, and we have agreed that in every month, we have a rotational meeting as governors. We will be rotating between Bor, Pibor, UI, which stands for Wat, and Akobo. And so we'll be going to Ayut, and we'll be meeting to discuss current peace-building issues.
Yes, let's hold your thoughts on that. I mean, for people who are not from South Sudan and who are not pastoralists, they would be wondering, why do you fight over cattle? What is the importance of cattle in your culture?
The livelihood of the Nilotic people and the Upper Nilean and the people of Jonglei, which who are part of the Great Upper Nile, is based on cattle. Is the main source of livelihood for the families, milk, and is used as a material in the dowry for marriages for the youth. And cattle has been a symbol of the prestige with this tribe of Dinka.
How many cattle do you have?
Me, I have no cattle, because if you don't, I'm not poor and I have no cattle. Because those who keep the cattle in the village are the real owners of the cattle. So my brothers and my cousin may have cattle, and these are our cattle to talk African or Dinka language. We have no poor people. We are either, if one of your brothers have cattle or your uncle, then you have cattle. So me, I enjoy the cattle that belong to the extended family. So we believe the rustling on cattle will end as soon as we have peace, because we will embark on disarmament. The devil lies in the spread of the small arms in the hand of civilian. And we have agreed, the five governors of Jonglei State, we are going to establish a joint integrated police in a place called Gadiang, and that will establish law and order. And after that, if we have a professionally trained police, then we will disarm the civilian, so that we allow chance for cultivation, for joint projects that will bring all the ethnicities of Greater Jonglei, the six of them, to a learning institution, to agricultural institution that will be based in a place called Gadiang.
All right. Colonel Philip Aguer, hold your thoughts on that. I will come back to you to explain to us why child abduction is rampant in the state. We will want to know why someone will come and pick a child that is not his or hers. Just hold your thoughts on that. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a Washington-based institute says peace building is critical to South Sudan's future. More on that when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what can be done to improve crop production in your region?
Okay, to improve crop production, we need funding. And then the farmers, they need to be sensitized and trained for better ways of planting crops or trees for fruits.
Introducing irrigation systems. As we know, we're living in the dry season and the rains are not frequently falling. So the irrigation systems can help farmers to grow the recommended crops they need.
To improve crop production in my region, the farmers should be practicing crop rotation. For example, this season, they should either cultivate maize and the next season, soya. Like the soya provides nutrients to the soil.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important Questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Some internally displaced persons who were relocated by the United Nations mission in South Sudan from the protection of civilian sites 3 at Jebel to Mangatin say they are facing difficulties as they start new life at their new camp. The IDPs say they are not convinced the peace agreement will end their sufferings and create a safe environment for them to return to their original homes. Dimo Silva Aurelio has this report for VOA from Juba.
Children are crammed inside a warehouse at Mangatin with barely any space to turn around and not enough ventilation. These IDPs were relocated 2 weeks ago from the UN Protection of Civilian Site 3, known as POC 3, in the Jebel area following deadly intercommunal clashes last month between communities from former Unity Estate. 30-year-old Angelina Nyenyalwel fled from the Mayum area of former Unity Estate to Juba during 2013 conflict. She now sells onions and groundnuts to earn a little money at Mangatin. Speaking in her native Nuer language, Nyenyawel says she was separated from her husband in 2013 when fighting broke out between SPLM-IO and the South Sudan Army in Mayum. Nyenyawel says she wants to return to Mayum but worries there is nothing left in her village. When I was in Mayum, I cultivated maize and have some cattle, Nyenyawel says. But when the conflict erupted, she says, all she had is gone. And that is why she is now selling these nuts and vegetables to earn a living. John Toot, a community leader at the Mangatin camp, says IDPs are facing more challenges these days.
The businessmen also lost their properties. Even also the children also are not going to school. See, the community always who stay in safety place, also they are worrying for their security.
Simon Kayal was a primary school teacher before the conflict erupted in December 2013. He fled to the POC in Juba during fighting in the capital. He says the recent communal violence at the POC 3 in Jebel terrifies him, and he does not think it is possible for South Sudanese to live together peacefully.
There is no hope. If people are still fighting, communal fighting, I think it doesn't make sense, because we have to unite the South Sudanese at first. Then when we are united, there is nothing like segregating. This is from a certain clan and this is from a certain tribe. And then this peace will be effective. Yes, but I'm happy, but in a half way, because during 2015, the peace was signed in Addis Ababa. All of us were actually in a very good mood. But unfortunately, the peace was also his fault. And it has also scared us and remain in POC.
A number of humanitarian organizations have set up temporary shelters at Mangatin to help the communities resettle. Gus Smith, Deputy Country Director for the Danish Refugee Council, says the IDPs feel it is not safe to return to their homes.
A few weeks ago, a number of people were moved to the Mangatin site from Juba POC 3. There was tension between two communities in Juba House. For imminent kind of security reasons, one group of the community was moved to the new Mangatin site at quite a rapid pace to protect their own safety. As a response, the humanitarian community came together to establish very much an emergency response for the new community who were being moved into the site. So very quickly, the priorities were to put in place shelter, water access, sanitation access, three latrines. So it was a very much a rapid emergency response to provide essential services at the start as people were moved into the site. Once the situation stabilised and the community was moved into the new site, there's been a process ongoing of starting to increase the services beyond that very rapid emergency phase. So over the coming week or so, we're going to be constructing more shelter to ensure that everyone has access to improved shelter conditions, to ensure that kind of schooling is established.
Smith says his office is providing a temporary rapid response to help the communities adjust to life in the camp and to also help South Sudanese plan a safe return to their homes. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Experiences of racism, tribalism, violence, and political instability can all lead to violence, according to the U.S. Institute of Peace. The U.S.-funded organization is looking at new ways to help youth and violence in their communities. As Ayen Deng Bio reports, experts at the USIP say the international community must partner with youth to look at new ways to address the causes of violence.
The U.S. Institute of Peace partnered with the Geneva-based United Nations Institute for Training and Research to convene a group of stakeholders to explore solutions and to maximize youth participation in peacebuilding. Allison Malofsky, who is on the curriculum and training design team at USIP, says their work has allowed them to learn from youth across the continent. As for the South Sudanese fellows who participated, Malofsky says they were able to let down their guard during the experience.
What it allowed them to do, our two South Sudanese fellows, was to speak, you know, and so they were able to speak because we're talking about perceptions of the other in this training. They're able to speak around their own identities and their tribal identities and their experience in South Sudan and their experiences engaging with law enforcement, and it was so powerful because their experience is their expertise.
Imrana Alhaji Buba, a youth representative and a USIP Generation Change Fellow from Nigeria, says they realized early on that local law enforcement was not familiar with their work to stem violent conflict in his community, so they had to come up with a plan.
Invite them to our programs, so when they come to see that, we show them this is what we do and this is the result, and they interact with the teachers. For example, in one of the schools, when we invited them and the principal was telling them about the impact, how the program changed the whole situation in the school. And so some of the local government officials were there at the program and they were so proud. And that is how they encouraged us to expand to other schools.
Aubrey Cox, a USIP program officer, says all the work that's being done across the continent is crucial, but it's more important to keep track of the changes.
We do measure change in fellows' leadership and peacebuilding programs. We also measure change that the beneficiaries have witnessed in the fellows, or their partners, not necessarily the beneficiaries. We also do more metrics and indicators of reach. So, for example, our fellows last year, we have 160 fellows, and they engaged almost 120,000 individuals in their communities, which is something that the U.S. government and our budget and our program could never do. So not only do we not have the money and the capacity to do it, we also don't have the legitimacy, credibility, and access to do it.
One major step, according to Malofsky, is to set up a youth advisory council where young people will determine the next steps to take and what's important to undertake for the future. Ayen Deng Bior, VOA News, Washington.
If you have just joined us, we have Colonel Philip Aguer, the governor of Jonglei State, with us here in the studio to explain why Jonglei State is making headlines. Colonel Aguer, we were just talking about child abduction. I was asking you, child abduction has been in the news from your state. Why would someone steal a child that does not belong to him or her? It doesn't just make sense to me.
In the modern world, you will call it trafficking in human. In Jonglei State, and particularly Greater Jonglei, some youth from the Murle have a definition of who is poor and who is not poor. For them, if you are alive and you are fit and you have gun, you are not poor. This is why they abduct a child, and a child will be traded with somebody who have cattle and in any quantity of cattle. And it is a socio-economic phenomena. Now, to solve it, you have to address the issue of education. You have to address the issue of youth employment and peace-building projects that can assure the youth that they have a future, that they have something to gain in living a peaceful life. But it has to be accomplished with the law enforcement agency, that is the police. So I think it's a crime, but it's simple to get resolved.
All right. And let's talk about the creation of the 32 states. I mean, President Kiir created 32 states, and at some point, Jonglei State was partitioned, you know.
Yes.
And how has that affected intercommunal relations with people who were once in Jonglei State and now they're in another state?
I think they are comfortable with it. And if you talk about the people people who was in war with the government, led by Yau Yau. And when they were given a separate administrative unit, they are comfortable and they are happy with it. And decentralization, if it is in the favor of conflict resolution, or if it is to bring services nearer to the people, it is acceptable. So the people of Greater Jongole are comfortable with their current state. This is my field observation, and being in contact with all the ethnicities of Greater Jongole, they are comfortable with the setup.
All right. We once covered a story from Jongole State where some civil servants who are very old are still working there. And when we asked them, "You are at a retirement age, why are you still in the office?" they said, "Well, we have been paying pension, and if we retire, we will not get our pension. So we are waiting here to get our pension." Could you talk to us a little bit about the pension scheme in Jongole State?
I think the pension scheme in Jongole State is connected with the national government. And the national government policy is preparing a pension budget. And when that budget is through, definitely those who will be on pension list will receive their pension payment while at their home. So it's a matter of time, and it will be implemented.
And why are you here? I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying you should not be in Washington.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm here. I was invited by the members of the diaspora from Jongole State, and I'm here communicating with them. Jongole State is one of the devastated states by the conflict. It started with the war of 21 years, with the war of 2013. The people of Jongole are all over the world. So I started to visit them. I'm visiting the people of Jongole State who are in the United States of America. And I'm talking to them about issues of peace, issues of how to think about home. Since they are connected with the country, we want them to be living with a purpose of what to do for your country. I'm talking about issues of unity among them, issues of living with other communities of Jongole of South Sudan. And me, as a SPLM interim chairperson for Jongole State, I wanted these people to think about peace, to be ambassadors of Jongole State, not only Jongole State, but good ambassadors of South Sudan.
Well, Colonel Philip Aguer, thank you very much for coming here and joining us in the studio today. We always welcome people who are very friendly to the media.
Thank you.
That was Colonel Philip Aguer, governor of Jongole State, here with us in the studio. That's our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song Halina Shtakal by Lomerika San.
Mashakil Africa kebeli ya kuluyo. Oh, mafidele katulu soti la jere jere kuluyo. Sala boda boda Deli se shoko. Oh, sala atali zatu Deli se shoko. Kuku kuku wate chejera wara shejera alabu kushena domuna. Wa mungu la wa wana sasi ya sata farid mabu wa dina gita.
Kelina shtaka, asha sana melede.
We have been listening to Lomerika San with the song Halina Shtakal. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Kelina shtaka, the hate street big kelimu. Verdet nina Bisena sifir, sifir, sifir Mikarabu nina. We'll create discriminations among our community. Let's stop doing this. Matagul kalamde Kalide jenge.